Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the Republican presidential primary shaping up, and what will be the fallout from Texas pushing back its own participation from Super Tuesday? The Lone Star State was originally scheduled to join the 11 others holding primaries March 3rd, and with 155 delegates up for grabs, would have been the most sought prize in the Super Tuesday lineup. But with lawmakers and minority groups still working on redistricting, it now appears the earliest possible date for the Texas elections will fall at the end of May. Of the four candidates remaining in the race for the GOP nomination, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney leads the pack so far with 149 delegates, followed by former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum with 86, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich with 29, and Texas Congressman Ron Paul with 18. So where does the election go from here? We have two expert guests to share their insights and observations this afternoon. William McKenzie is an editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bud Kennedy is a columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Bill, Bud, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Great. Thanks for having us.
So let's start with the state of things in Texas. How close are we to fully resolving these disputed legislative districts?
Well, go ahead, Bill. We have maps and we'll have a primary.
Exactly. So the question is fully resolving it. If I read it correctly, I mean, we're still looking at these maps to get us through this coming election. If it stands up in court and we don't – if these maps are not – somehow adjusted, overturned, whatever, by another court case going on in Washington at this point. So hopefully it will get us through, you know, this election, and then my understanding is then if the legislature could have option to come back in and do these districts differently.
Legislature may choose to redraw it next session, but we'll go through this election now. Of course, Chris, part of the story is that the primary is not on Super Tuesday. The primary is the day after Memorial Day, I think. Is that right? And then when we have runoffs, they'll go to the end of July. So it'll be a long, hot primary season in Texas, and everybody else will be done and on their summer vacation.
Right. And being an optimist, I would say perhaps the good thing about Texas having it on May 29th, that's what it looks like it'll end up being, is that if this race, which doesn't look like it's ever going to die, if it continues on, then Texas does get to be a really big deal maker because it would come right before the California primary on June 5th or 6th. Having said that, I think we really lost an opportunity here. You remember, you go back to 08, and when Hillary and Obama were through here, it was really exciting. And that was the first time in my recollection for probably 16 years since we'd had a real competitive presidential primary here, going back to Clinton and Paul Tsongas in 92. And it was fun, and it was good, and it activated voters, and they got to hear these candidates up front. And so instead of this week having Romney and Santorum coming through here, delivering their speeches, doing all this sort of thing, you know, we don't get to see them. You know, people get to see them when they come through here to raise money, but they really don't get a whole lot of chances to see them.
Well, actually, you know, Chris, I mean, if Texas were voting next week, Texas would be the biggest election on Super Tuesday. And you think about it, it really wouldn't just be two candidates. You know, the governor has supported Newt Gingrich. The other southern states have supported Newt Gingrich. And although his campaign has faltered, you know, all this last couple of weeks, part of the rhetoric of the campaign would have been Newt Gingrich is looking forward to Texas, and Newt Gingrich is looking forward to a big win in Texas to put him over the top. And it would have been, you know, Gingrich, Santorum, and of course Romney campaigning heavily in the state.
Right. And so here's the irony. Texas Republicans and legislature drew the maps in a way that they couldn't pass court muster, and so therefore they denied their party a chance in Texas to really be a kingmaker of sorts.
Well, you never know. I mean, it reminded me of, you know, people who buy the very last ad spot in the Super Bowl. Either you've lost everybody or you get absolutely
Correct.
A bang for your buck.
Right.
Now, of course, the other side of this is, like Bill started with, if you really are a Santorum true believer and you think that in May that Texas is going to be the big state that puts him over the top against the Romney machine, then, you know, you can say that Texas becomes a trump card. But when you look at the states and the way they fall, really, I think next Tuesday is the last chance for Santorum to make any kind of big splash and to stave off the inevitable Romney march. You know, the states fall Romney's way until you get to Texas, you know, after next week.
All right, and I would agree with that. But if Santorum does break through in another state next week, then this race is not over, a big state that is, and so we continue. And so far, that has been the trajectory of this race. It just doesn't die. You know, it keeps going.
You know, you can look at the rise and fall of each candidate, and you know, each candidate has had about 2 or 3 weeks of being really popular, and then fallen back. And this is, you know, based on that pattern, this is kind of the end of Santorum's swing. But you know, he's quite capable of, you know, coming up with a big win someplace, coming up with a surprise, and bobbing back up to the top.
We sure have seen a lot of him in Texas. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. he's looking for the kind of money that GOP donors in this state typically shell out. But it would appear that he does have an eye on maybe still being in the race in a couple of months.
Well, I think he came through here largely to get money when he came to McKinney and some other suburban parts of North Texas. And I don't fault him for that. I think he should do that. And he held rallies, and people had a chance to come out to see him. So that was good. But what I'm talking about is something different from them coming here and spending more time and, in essence, planting their flag in the state and really trying to woo voters. I don't imagine they would. I don't envision a New Hampshire-Iowa thing where they're going to camp out here for long periods of time, but we would have seen more of them.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about the loss of Olympia Snow. She now is not going to run for re-election. Many people are saying this is the death of the moderate in the U.S. legislature.
Well, I spent 12 years in Washington, D.C., working for moderate Republican causes, so this is kind of near and dear to my heart. And Olympia Snow was on the board of the group I work for, the Ripon Society. And I was thinking back, reading this story about her retiring, when I started working there, excuse me, in 1981, I think we had close to 40 members of the House who were part of our advisory board, and they were moderate Republicans. And we had another 15 or 20 in the Senate. So we had a pretty good chunk of moderate Republicans. It had a big chunk of moderate Republicans in Congress. You know, in the House, I don't know what the numbers are, but they are really small. And in the Senate, with Olympia Snow going, you know, you're down to counting them out on one hand, you know, the number of moderate Republicans are left. And so, you know, personally, I hate to see that, but I think for the larger cause, the country, when you lose the moderate Republicans and you lose some of the blue dog Democrats, the conservative Democrats, you lose the people who are there, who are able to speak across party lines, talk to each other, you know, in the proverbial back rooms, and understand each other and not just speak past each other. And those kinds of folks continue to disappear.
You want to add anything to that, Bud?
Well, I think the Republicans have intended to lose the moderates. I think that the strategy going back to Tom DeLay and the redistricting and the way the lines were drawn and, you know, was intended to eliminate yellow dog Democrats and moderate Republicans and to elect, you know, and to stack the votes for as many, you know, hardcore right-wing Republicans as possible. You know, Olympia, you know, her biggest problem is that she was not welcome in her own party, you know, and not treated well by her own party. And Maine's an independent-minded state anyway. You know, remember, Maine is the only state where Ross Perot finished second. Bill Clinton actually finished third in Maine. So, you know, she was a good fit for Maine, but even in Maine, she no longer felt at home.
What about on the Democratic side? Is it tougher to be a moderate there as well?
You know, the Democrats, the only thing the Democrats have in common right now, you have a lot of totally different niche groups in the Democratic Party whose only, you know, common ground is that they're all against the Republicans. You know, I think that it is tough to be. I'll give you an example. Just imagine being a pro-life Democrat. You know, you had the congressman from North Carolina. You have how many pro-life Democrats are there? 2, 3? You know, a small handful. And particularly during the recent controversies, you can imagine the kind of derision they endure.
Well, I'm going to differ some with that. In that I think it is easier to be a moderate in the Democratic Party today. And for this reason, the Democrats learned their lesson after McGovern. You know, they got mm-hmm. whacked, and it took them years to come back until Clinton came back with the new Democrat philosophy. And so I think there's more space in the Democratic Party for moderates. You look in the Texas legislature, in the Texas House, there are a number of moderate Democrats, Rafael Rafael Anchia from here being one, Mark Strama from Austin being another, and they are a force within the Texas House, and the Texas House is solidly Republican. So I'm not saying they control it, but they are. You see them up on the mic. You see them making arguments. They're influential in debates, and they are there. What you don't see in the Republican Party is as much space for moderates, because I don't think the Republican Party has learned its McGovern lesson yet. And so at some point, the party is going to go so far to the right that they're going to learn their McGovern lesson and have to come back and reclaim the center. It's not there yet.
Let's go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org. We have Declan on the line in Carlton. Hi, Declan.
Hi. I have a question about voting district maps, and I'm thinking even ignoring the current contention over redistricting, it just seems to me like voting districts are kind of an antiquated concept, the notion that you can tie people together just based on their geography. And I'm wondering, you know, is there, what's the main justification for that? And is there any plausible potential for the state to do away with voting districts altogether? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
The principle of one man, one vote still reigns, and it's very important. Both when you get down to even to cities have single-member districts. Some school districts have single-member districts. You know, it's all meant to be sure that everybody gets included and that everyone is represented. I don't think you can ever get away from one man, one vote.
No, and I agree with Bud, and it's a very important principle. And I think also, you know, the whole concept of communities of interest is one of the factors that goes into play in drawing these districts, and I think that's important, you know, that voters are paired together with people who may be of like mind, or they share some commonality, you know, by living in a certain community. I think that's important, and you wouldn't get that if you did away with districts.
People in Texas right now see minority districts as serving minorities, but as the population changes in Texas, Anglos will begin to see the value of single-member districts.
So let's talk a little bit more about Super Tuesday. Of course, the big prizes there are Ohio and Georgia. Can we assume that Newt Gingrich will win his home state of Georgia?
You know, I'm not a Georgia expert, but I don't necessarily make that assumption. I mean, you look how hard it is for members of Congress to win statewide in Texas, even though Georgia is smaller and Newt's a bigger name. I don't know if I'd necessarily say he wins Georgia, because members of Congress are a little bit more parochial than a senator or governor or something like that. So, you know, I'm not sure. From Newt's side, he needs to win someplace soon, and that would be his best bet.
Of course, this is where Santorum has come in the last couple of days. Santorum would really like to win a state in the South and to say, you know, look at me, I can travel. Right now, Santorum still looks like a Pittsburgh Northeastern religious conservative, and he hasn't made that headway, you know, in the rest of the country. He would really like to pick up a state, and if he can just drive Gingrich's vote down enough, he can at least pick up some momentum as a representative of Southern conservatives.
All right. Well, I believe, Bud, you were in Iowa earlier on. I went to New Hampshire, and I will say this positive about Santorum. He was very articulate in representing his point of view. And if you shared his point of view, a social, cultural, economic conservatism, he would be a good leader for you. But he has yet to connect with Republicans on the main issue in this race, and that's the economy.
We're talking this hour about Super Tuesday and the upcoming elections with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News and Bud Kennedy of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about Super Tuesday with columnists Bud Kennedy of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. If you want to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We can look at this from a variety of angles, however you look at it, the GOP nominee will have less to criticize about the Obama administration's approach to the economy than even a few months ago. Things are, by many measures, looking up. How do you think that's affecting what's taking place right now between the GOP nominee candidates?
Well, I don't know to what effect it's having on their conversation. Their critique of Obama. I mean, it seems like Romney still is trying to make Obama the issue when he is out on the stump. And this health care bill it resonates with a lot of voters, and the repeal of the Affordable Care Act is still a rallying point in a lot of Republican caucuses and precincts. And so I think there's still that issue is still alive, and they're still making hay with it.
Well, the new talk is about gas prices, and gas prices is the new point to hammer the president on. But so far, the economy is not playing as the issue. It may change and will change over time. And, everyone always says, if it comes down to November, it just depends on where the economy is and whether people are satisfied or not.
Although, I mean, the economy still turns out to be the major issue in most of these primaries and caucuses. That's the one that keeps showing up pretty consistently, that people are most concerned about. And that's where I think Romney really has the strength. Policies aside, I'm not here to argue whether his tax reform plans beats Santorum's or beats Obama. He has an acumen and a background that I think that's a strength. And somehow he should keep trying to parlay that into votes as he goes along, because he's the only guy who can get up there and say, I've spent my career looking in through a lens into American businesses, and I know what makes them work and what makes them not work. And yes, sometimes I've made the wrong bets and I've made the wrong decisions. That's part of the capitalism. But I'm the one who has really been able to look deeply into these, and I know what their fundamentals are, and I can take that knowledge and use it as president.
This is really why Romney's gaining some ground. I mean, we said for months, the thing about Romney, he's always got this ceiling. He never gets more than 25 or 30% of the vote. Well, now we've seen him break through that ceiling, and he's moving into the 40% range in some of the primaries. He's gaining ground because he's talking about the economy, and for whatever reason, Rick Santorum has gotten bogged down in social issues, and Romney talks about money and business and traditional free enterprise Republican issues.
Let's talk about the size of government and what is appropriate from the perspective of these candidates. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution had a really interesting piece on February 22nd, and I'm going to paraphrase and quote from it. According to a study that was produced not by the Journal-Constitution but by the Tax Policy Center, which is a bipartisan or nonpartisan group based in D.C., it's a joint project, of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Gingrich's plan would add $7 trillion to the nation's debt over the coming 9 years, almost doubling the deficits that would be recorded if the government basically ran on autopilot. And this is quoting directly from the article. Santorum's plan would add $4.5 trillion over the period, or $500 billion every year. Romney's proposal would add $250 billion to the deficit over 9 years. Ron Paul's plan does, in fact, add nothing to the deficit, but cuts government to a far greater extent than anyone else. Is this something that Republican voters are thinking about? Are they looking for what's actually at the bottom line when these candidates are discussing what they want to do with the government?
I don't think voters generally vote on specifics of policies. Mm-hmm. I used to hope they would, and having worked on a presidential campaign and worked on policy development, I sure would like to think they do. I don't think they do. Mm-hmm. I think they vote on something different, trust being the number one factor. And so, therefore, I go back to what I'm saying about Romney. keep talking about your experience. Keep talking about what you know about American businesses, and keep playing on that. To this article, I mean, if his plan only adds $250 billion to the deficit over a 10-year period, that's minimal. Mm-hmm. You know, and I would take that as a good thing if I were Romney. Of course, we want deficit reduction over time, but if you're only adding $250, that's not that much. I mean, well, Republicans are really going to
It's funny the world we're living in he comes out on top, you know.
Right. But here's the challenge for Republicans. It all has to do with the size of the tax cuts you want.
Right.
And what I would love to see us have is a discussion about tax reform that takes – and Obama started it the other day when talking about wanting to lower corporate tax rates and get rid of some loopholes. His, if I understand it correctly, would lead to a net tax increase, which is different from saying we're going to have a tax reform, we're going to get rid of a bunch of loopholes, and we're going to change this, that, and the other thing beyond corporate tax rates, and we'll keep it revenue neutral. And what that strategy is why I think that's appealing is you're not really going to get into debate but with Republicans if you're leading a tax increase, but you're going to reform the tax code. And I think that would help businesses in the long run. I think that produces the growth that will provide revenues for the Treasury.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Chris in Louisville. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just have a comment to make, and basically the Republican Party, because they played such a hard-line game, have basically dragged the Democrats to the center, where the Democrats are now almost a center-right party. And for earlier, one of the comments was that the Republicans need to reclaim the center. Well, that's where the Democrats are at now. I think they need to move a little further left. In Europe, the Democrats would still be considered a right-wing party. And that's about it.
Thanks for your call. You guys want to respond to that?
Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't quarrel that the Democratic Party is going to look more center-right compared to what's going on in Europe. Having said that, I don't think the Democratic Party today is center-right. I think Bill Clinton tried to make it that, and I think he was center-right. In all due respect to President Obama, I don't think he sees himself or is center-right. I think he's center-left. I don't think he's hard-left, but I think he is definitely center-left. And there's a difference between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And I think that the Democratic Party today in the House, for example, you know, in the U.S. House, the way districts are drawn, it rewards a liberal more than it does somebody who's center-right.
You know, if you think the Democrats are moderate, then you really can't see the left field wall from where you're standing. You know, we've had the age. There's been nothing but pressure in recent years from the activist groups such as Move On to make the Democrats more liberal. And a lot of the new Democrats who have been elected were elected by activists because they were more liberal than their predecessors. I mean, they are trying to move the Democrats to the left and not to the center.
What is Ron Paul still doing in this race, given his relative lack of delegates? What does he want from
well,
this?
Well, there was a theory, and it's still there, that he is doing this in part to lay the groundwork for his son, Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky. And there was a story last week, and I forgot where this was, about Romney and Paul perhaps creating an alliance, and that in the article is talking about that you don't see Paul attacking Romney, which is kind of true. You don't see Romney attacking Paul. The alliance, the suggestion is, would be created to perhaps get Rand Paul considered as a vice president or to have some influence over, you know, the Romney campaign.
It's a fascinating theory. It sounds like something out of a novel.
Right, yeah. But I picked this up in New Hampshire. You know, mm-hmm. There was some speculation that Paul was doing this to lay the groundwork for his son, perhaps to have a run in 2016 himself.
You know, there's quite a bit of talk about Romney and Paul agreement. And of course, somebody on CNN asked Ron Paul about that the other night. He had this wonderfully hilarious answer. He said, well, some people are just infatuated with conspiracy theory, you know, coming from Ron Paul of all people. But, you know, the reason Ron Paul is still running is because somebody has to carry that brand. And, you know, that is a brand that is a book-selling brand, that is a speech-making brand, that is a 10% of the vote in America brand that will continue until the day Ron Paul, you know, bestows it on a successor, whether it's Rand or one of his other children or Deborah Medina or whoever, you know, but the, right. that is a brand that he has to keep in the marketplace. And the day he leaves the campaign is the day that leaves the marketplace.
And his views are not my own, but I admire the guy. What is he, 76 years old, and he's flying from stop to stop, and he's out there stumping. And I kind of, you know, admire this guy for going out and continuing to argue his point of view.
And you look at the polls in Florida, and Republicans under 30 voted overwhelmingly for Paul in Florida. You know, when you go to campuses, you know, Ron Paul is the most popular Republican on campus. Young Republicans are very interested in a more libertarian view of politics and also in a more libertarian view of evangelical Christianity. And Ron Paul really hits home with the kind of voters that the Republicans have carefully groomed.
You got an interesting piece, Bill, recently, I think, about, did you write about evangelicals under 30 versus evangelicals over 30?
Right. And in 08, President Obama did fairly well with younger evangelicals. They kind of liked his message about hope. There's a lot of data that shows younger evangelicals are more interested in social justice, environmental responsibility, than perhaps they are in abortion or gay marriage. Not that they're not interested in that, but it just doesn't resonate the same way it does with older evangelicals. But polling data so far this year shows that they have moved, those younger evangelicals have moved away from Obama. And in some cases, they are identifying with the Republican Party more than their parents, who may be their than older evangelicals.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ken in Plano. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hi. I think we can all agree there's an ideological difference between Fox News and MSNBC, right? So my question is, how will the ideological differences between the news organizations affect this election? Because, you know, today it was all Andrew Breitbart and how tragic that death is on Fox News, and truly MSNBC couldn't care about it. So I was wondering if you could address that. Thank you very much.
I think it's already affected the election. I mean, I think Rick Santorum is in many ways Fox News' buddy. I mean, I think he is a, you know, New York Catholic conservative who works and who speaks the language of many of the commentators at Fox. I think it's already affected the primary process in that many commentators are more at home with Santorum than they are with Gingrich or definitely with Rick Perry.
And I would agree with that. I don't know what influence it's going to have in the general election, because let's assume MSNBC leans towards the Democrats and Fox leans towards the Republicans. You know, they aren't necessarily going to grow their market. They're going to appeal to who they already appeal to. Mm-hmm. And so people who want Obama are probably going to tune into MSNBC to be reaffirmed. People who want, let's assume for the second it's Romney or the Republican nominee, they're going to turn into Fox to get reaffirmed for what they want.
I'm curious about these 20 debates that we've had, and there was supposed to be another one next week that has been canceled. Have they been effective, in your opinion, in letting voters know who it is that they are choosing?
Well, I don't want to argue against debates because it's healthy, and I think it has exposed these candidates to a lot more Americans who don't get to see them in Dubuque, Iowa, or Nashua, New Hampshire. And I think that's healthy and that's good. And so way to go. But clearly it has just torn these. It's led to, you know, these guys are tearing each other up. And I think it's going to be hard for them to come together over the summer and at the convention. I'm not saying they cannot, but these debates, which have just allowed these divisions to be presented in prime time, I think are going to make it hard for the Republican Party. And I saw John McCain say something the other day. He thought we'd had too many of them, and I think, and I may be wrong, saying that, you know, he hopes that next time out we don't do as many.
I think both parties need to look at the December debates. You know, the December debates on commercial networks exist for the same reasons that we have some 38 college bowl games. They exist to fill network time and sell advertising during, before, and after the debates during the heavy holiday shopping season. The candidates are primarily providing commercial programming at a high advertising sales
season.
That
is so cynical to say it that way.
And I think that is the reason all the networks schedule their mid-December debates. Mm-hmm. And I think that it really didn't serve the parties will, to have how many would there were like 8 or 9 debates in the weeks of late November, early December, and I went to one of them in Iowa that I was just amazed. It was, you know, every moment was hanging on. We'll be back with more from Newt Gingrich after this message from, you know, KB Toys or whatever. And just, it was incredible that it was a whole commercial event. And I think the parties need to look at, do they need to accept everyone's invitation, and do they need to be a part of what is essentially Christmas season marketing in America?
Having said that, I do want to stand up for debates. If we're going to have all these reality TV shows on and we're going to have, 38 bowl games, and I've watched my fair share of bowl games, but if we're going to have all these other venues on TV, you know, at one level, I'm glad to see the political discussion have its own marketplace and so many people wanting to turn into it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Don in Fort Worth. Hi, Don.
Hi. I just have a question. Why in the world do the Republicans and in general try to blame Obama for high gas prices, and they get away with it? If Obama had any control over gas prices, don't they think he would do it just to take the credit?
Well, in defense of the Republicans, Don, I'm sure the Democrats would do the same thing if they didn't have the White House. But do you guys want to address that?
Well, I heard Jeb Bush speak here last week, and he brought up the fact about how his brother got crucified for gas prices, and, you know, back in the middle part of his reign. So, you know, he got gas prices hung around his neck. And so, you know, this comes with the territory. I would agree. I don't think Obama per se controls the gas prices any more than George W. Bush did. There are certain policies that can alleviate the situation. And I think it's legitimate to have a critique of some of Obama's energy policies and his approach to the oil and gas industry. But I'm not. That isn't necessarily going to get us down to lower gas prices by June.
We are speaking this hour with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News and Bud Kennedy of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram about the Republican primary race. If you would like to come, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Bud Kennedy of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. We are talking about the GOP primary race for the presidential elections later this year. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Chris, I just want to – there's one thing I want to be sure we talk about. You know, Rick Santorum is living – Rick Perry's dream, and I think that's something that we should really talk about. You know, had Rick Perry stayed in the race, he would have gone to Florida in this showdown with Romney. He would be the candidate who is, you know, the controversy. Is he too conservative? Is he too religious? You know, in many ways, the way these states fell are the ways that Rick Perry mapped out his campaign.
But did Santorum have the same kinds of gaffes early on that tripped up the Perry campaign?
Well, of course, that's why Rick Perry isn't living this mm-hmm. dream now. But this is the campaign that Rick Perry wanted to be in, and the campaign where he thought he would bring more business sense and more ability to address the economy than Santorum does. This Rick Santorum is where Rick Perry thought he would be.
And I think there's a good reason why Santorum is there and Perry isn't. Watching Santorum back in New Hampshire, this guy on several different places, and he'd get up on a park bench sometimes and just start talking extemporaneously. And he's like Bill Clinton. He would talk for a long period of time. He create a narrative, and he'd bring in also policies. And you could see this guy had, you know, 4 years in the House, 12 years in the Senate, and that sort of training pays off. You're used to debating. He had no notes, and you're able to sit up and talk about these issues. You have a familiarity with him from AIDS in Africa to, you know, contraception, whatever. He spans the range. Perry doesn't have that and didn't have that. As being the governor, he wasn't playing at that level in the national issues. But second, he didn't really prepare himself, and it showed up clearly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Reggie in DeSoto. Hi, Reggie.
Hello, Chris. Continue to love your show.
Thank you.
It appears to me that today's Republicans, at least the majority of them, will never have a true winner system in the future, and especially picking a president, because it's too hodgepodge and radical with the religious extremes. Extremes on social issues, continuing with racial injustices, where minorities that's even on the fence are terrified to join the party. They just seem to dismiss the true pulse and population trend of this country. And they seem to me that they need a true agenda. They need to be sitting down and discussing the true nature of this country on Super Tuesday instead of worrying about the vote.
Well, I think the caller has a point, a couple points. One is, I think religion and politics mix. They mix naturally. They're about values. And we always will have this discussion, and we should have the discussion. Having said that, I attended a GOP Senate debate here in Dallas last week with Tom Leppard, Craig James, Ted Cruz, and several other candidates. And I thought as I was listening to this, I felt like I was at a Billy Graham rally. I went to a Billy Graham rally, and nothing wrong with Billy Graham rally. But I thought also, as you're listening to this, there's so much invoking of Jesus' name in this that I thought, you know, what happens if you didn't share that point of view? How would you feel about being here? So I think Republicans really need to watch that and to figure out, you know, to what extent they really want to be a political party, which it works best when you have a coalition of interest. Second, and I think the caller was talking about this in terms of minority voters. You know, if you look back what both George W. Bush and John McCain did, they were trying to bring in Latino voters into the Republican Party. To Rick Perry's credit, I think he's gotten this. He kind of plays it both ways, but he gets it. And the party at this point is doing their level best to drive Latino voters away from them by the issues they're choosing to emphasize. And I don't get it.
Well, go ahead, Bud.
Well, I was just going to say this is the point I was going to make, too, that, you know, there are people in the Republican Party that see that Latino voters share the ideals of free enterprise and startup businesses and also family values, that Latino voters really, if you look around and say who are going to be the Republicans of the future, I mean, they're not, you know, as one of the Republican, you know, leaders in Texas said, they're not making Anglo-Republicans anymore in Texas. You know, who are the Republicans of the future? They're Latinos. And so there are leaders who see that and who see that getting at least 40% of the Latino vote is the key. But then you have all these candidates that are just setting fire to all this goodwill all around the country.
So we spoke briefly earlier about what the GOP is going to have to do once the nominee has been established to sort of come back together as a party. There's also the issue of what they're going to need to do in order to win this election in the fall. They will need some somewhat moderate social voters. They will need some voters who have sort of in between positions. And that has not been what this primary election has focused on. To any extent, how do they begin to repair whatever rifts might exist between the Republican Party and then that vast amount of undecided voters that live in the middle?
Well, that's what those high-paid strategists get paid a lot of bucks for, because they're going to have to figure this out, because it's going to be really tough, more so in any election that I recall in a good while. So that's going to be a big, big challenge, and I hope they're thinking about it now. But having said that, I would quarrel with what you said earlier, that I think the economy is still going to be an issue. I don't think, and we should all be glad that it's doing better. Absolutely. But it's still going to be an issue. And I think to the extent that if Romney's the nominee, if he can keep talking to the entrepreneurial class in America and keep talking to people who may not be really aligned with the Republican Party, the Silicon Valley sorts or the people around Austin who are people who do deals, you know, wherever they are, speak to them in a way that is authoritative and show them that he is the guy that they can that they would want to be president. I think that is how you reach some of these independent voters if you're Romney. I will concede, though, the way they've been going makes it hard on these social cultural issues.
I'd just say you already see some of that adjustment when you saw in Virginia, when you saw the Governor O'Donnell in Virginia walking back the sonogram, vaginal wanding part of the sonogram issue, and you saw, Governor O'Donnell might be on the ticket with Reagan. He might be the choice. And, you just see that the Republicans in a potential swing state don't want to do anything that, endangers the Republican ticket in the fall.
You talk about swing state. The most important swing state on Tuesday, of course, is Ohio. What makes that such a battleground?
It's a swing state between Rick Santorum's friends in Pittsburgh and Romney's friends in Michigan. It's literally a swing state between the two, and it's a state with religious conservative overtones, with blue collar workers. It's a state that where the Republicans should be developing a lot of their fall vote.
Well, Romney's got friends in Michigan, but he only won half the delegates in the state.
He may have won only half the delegates, but he won the big story. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big story was it looked like he was going to get upset in his home state, and he won. And I think that was significant. Why does Ohio matter? It is, perhaps what Texas is not, in the sense that it is a collection of competing interest. And I'm not saying we're not a – obviously we have complete competing interest, but we are more of a Republican state. And it's a state where you're going to have different constituencies having a shot at electing a candidate, constituencies from different parties, that is. And so it's more up in the air. And in the Republican Party, Bud talked about this, you got evangelicals, you got blue-collar voters, you have different groups that may be the same person, they may not be the same person. And so, it's up for grabs.
Email here from Mike wants to know, do you think Rick Perry has damaged his future political status in Texas with his poor debate performance?
I think, Rick Perry said last week that the most damaging thing that he said was that if you don't let illegal immigrants go to college, you don't have a heart. He said that was actually what had done him more damage than anything else. I think that the governor has become a punchline, and a lot of clips will live in YouTube for years to come. Right now, his goal has to be to settle back into Texas and rebuild his brand. And he'll do some national campaigning for the Republican ticket, but he needs to sell books and he needs to kind of restore himself as somebody to be taken seriously.
I've never been able to predict Rick Perry. He's just a mystery to me. And so I can't really tell you what I know Rick Perry will end up doing, nor do I know how well he will do, because while he didn't do well nationally, there are times I've thought he wouldn't do well here, and he does. So that possibility exists. But I think what's going to harm Rick Perry and where he got hit the most damage is among Republican money folks. I'm sure they're going to go out and stake their capital in him for another go-round. They've been through this for how many years? 11 years now, something like that. And by next time up, he'll be there 14 years, and he's had that experience at the national level. I'm not sure there are going to be a whole lot of those people who are willing to go out and say, yeah, we really need to get behind Rick Perry. I think they'll start looking for other people to run, and certainly there are others who are interested in running.
And I think he hurt himself most with the religious right. I mean, they almost begged him to run this time. They said, we have to have somebody to go out and run who'll go out and a crusade Rick, are you up to it? Well, what, you haven't tithed any money to your church? Well, that's okay. We'll overlook that. I mean, they just drafted him into running, and that is a group that if you're not a winner, they ditch you quickly. And the religious right leaders want a winner. They think this time that Karen Santorum will be the first lady that they want, and that was part of what drove their recommendation for Santorum. But I think they've already dropped Rick Perry and won't consider him again.
What are the chances, realistically, that someone at this stage can come from wherever they are, those second, third, and fourth place finishes, and really beat Mitt Romney for this nomination?
Well, I think it is it is getting increasingly harder, but again, because this race has been so topsy-turvy, I don't rule out the possibility that Santorum more than Romney makes another run. Santorum more than Gingrich mm-hmm. makes another run at Romney. It can happen. Nobody predicted Colorado, and there he won that state, and that was what kind of gave him new life. So that possibility exists. If he wins Ohio, it certainly helps his cause. I don't think he does win Ohio, but if he does, that's going to help him. And so I think it is conceivable that we're still going to be talking about Romney and Santorum in another month. I don't think we're going to be talking about Newt Gingrich unless he just really catches fire. And I think we get down to a three-person race with Paul kind of doing his stuff every now and then, more likely Romney and Santorum.
I think the 24-hour news cycle has made everything so volatile. Mm-hmm. We've seen such incredible mood swings. I would say that it's probably over, but if Mitt Romney goes out tomorrow and makes up another $10,000 bet and talks about his wife's two Cadillacs and then suddenly starts losing ground. I mean, anybody can, one soundbite can deep six a campaign, and we've seen that for the last few months.
Well, let's talk about that because Romney has made a series of missteps, and he has acknowledged that. On the other hand, it's not as if the other gentlemen who are still in the race are not in the top 1%. What is it about Romney that rankles people?
Oh, I think people just see Romney as a Richie Rich, caricature. I think they just perceive him as the guy, with the cigarette holder standing around the pool at the cabana, or something.
the dollar sign bag with the big S on it.
They see him as the guy on the Monopoly card, and that doesn't play well.
And yet he said, look, I'm not going to apologize. I built my businesses honestly, and I'm proud of what I did. Is that not good enough for people?
Well, I think there is a fault line in this election, and it depends in part on how you view success. And I think if Romney is able to say to people, yeah, I have made a lot of money, but this is about creating jobs. If you're a business, it's about creating wealth. It's about the American dream, and everybody should have a shot at it, versus if you're going to say, well, this guy is rich, and therefore we should stick it to him. And I think there's just a dividing line. But, Romney does not help his cause when he comes out, as Bud said, and said, my wife is driving a couple of Cadillacs. You can imagine the strategist in the back room saying, Mitt, couldn't you just have said, yeah, she drives cars, but you have to say she drives a couple of Cadillacs, for goodness sake. So he doesn't help his cause with moments like this. And I remember talking to somebody who worked with Romney long ago, who said, look, worse things could happen if he's elected. He's a business guy. He gets in. This person was a Democrat. He said, but my worry about him is he may not really have a gut-level feel for the average person. Mm-hmm. And why that is, I don't know.
And we talked earlier off, Mike. I mean, this is a factor in the primary where he's against this bulldog coal miner country, Santorum. But, it's not as much of a factor in the general election. You go to the general election, he's up against a Harvard lawyer who has his own criticism for being, too distant and too much of an elitist Democrat. So and it's not as much of a factor in the fall.
Sorry, but we were talking about this at a break. I mean, in New Hampshire, his rallies, Romney's rallies, they were well attended. People were excited. It wasn't like he was, to use the Richie Rich metaphor, that he was up on the stage and people felt like there were, serfs in the audience. He was really he connected with them, and they didn't talk about him personally, but they liked what he was saying, what they would do, and what they think he could do to fix the economy. And there was juice in the rally. And that may not always be the case if he were, I'm not sure Bill Gates goes out and has juice in a rally.
And I was at a Romney rally in Iowa, and I surveyed everybody I could find in the room. I could only find 7 people who weren't paid to be there.
Got to leave it there. Bud Kennedy is a columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. William McKenzie is an editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Guys, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/thinks. Think, email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.